thanks everyone for coming for our first in-person talk of the spring, with featuring one in-person speaker and one in-person audience member.
Woo-woo!
Our speaker today will be Justin Hilburn, our own colleague. And as you can see, he'll tell us about going towards two categorical previews.
Okay, thank you guys for coming, both of you. So I think that this should maybe stay then pretty informal. So what I want to try and do is explain some of the content that didn't make it into a paper that I just wrote with Ben Gamage and Aaron Mazelji. In particular, you know, we wrote a paper like attempting to, you know, give a definition of two categorical 3D mirror symmetry for abelian theories, but we didn't really give like much justification about why our definitions were good. We just, you know, proved a theorem, and so I think in this talk, I'm just going to talk about the stuff that got cut from the paper, just about like what's the general context and like what were we trying to do. And then at the end, I'll talk about what we actually did. So just in case like anybody like comes in and watches this later, recall that like the context that I'm studying are 3D n equals 4 gauge theories. And just like very similar to like the situation of 2D n equals 2 comma 2 gauge theories that give rise to like ordinary mirror symmetry, these field theories basically admit like two different topological twists, which I will refer to as the 3D A model and the 3D B model. And this theory is often called Rozanski-Witten theory. And this 3D A model is basically 3D Seiberg-Witten theory, or at least the generalized version. And it is not it's not the same thing as there's another thing called the 3DA model, which was studied in a paper of Kustin, Bias, and Setter. And basically, the theory that I'm about to talk about coincides with that in a couple of cases, but it's not the same in general. So if you look up a paper on the 3DA model, the only other one you'll find is this, and it's not that. Okay, and so like as is sort of well known, is there no board behind her? Like as is very well known at this point, a 3D TQFT can be viewed as a functor from a certain three category of cobordisms to the three category of stable linear two categories. So I'll call this thing two star. So here ST, I think it's supposed to be the two category stable the two categories. Sorry, three category. And so from each of these two topological field theories, I should be able to get a functor like this. And if I have, there's a notion of 3D mirror symmetry, which exchanges these 3D n equals 4 theories. And if I have two mirror theories, we'll get two of these functors and that they should be equivalent. And I just want to tell you maybe a little bit about like what's known about these field theories like in different cases. So people are very familiar at this point with what this theory assigns to a two-sphere. So this is the E3 algebra of local operators. And in the A model, this is basically work of Braverman, Finkelberg, and Nakajima that describe this in terms of this Coulomb branch construction. And in the B model, I guess this is known at least like since Rosansky and Witten, that the local operators here are just Dolbeau cohomology of the Higgs branch. There is a certain braided monoidal category, which is like the category of line operators. And this has been studied in many special cases. I would claim that basically BFN sort of already knew what the answer was on the A side. And I think on the B side, it was kind of clear that it would be some kind of coherent sheaves on a loop space. I think like the like first, I guess other than like a paper of Houston, Rosansky, and Solana where they study this, I would say that the other big sort of papers here were a paper that I wrote with Demofte, Garaci, Garner, and then a paper that I wrote with Sam Raskin where we proved mirror symmetry for abelian theories. But the thing that's like that actually like determines the whole theory and is like the most interesting is that there's a certain two category of boundary conditions. And this was studied by Kapustin, Rosansky, and Solana, and later by just Kapustin and Rosansky. And like on the A side, basically there's like very, very little that's known about this. Like it's basically a complete mystery. So the only real work that's really been done in this case is by Telemann, and he did it in the case of pure gauge theory. But other than that, this part of the diagram or part of the table is just a complete mystery. And so what I'd like to focus on this talk is I want to tell you a little bit about like what the category of boundary conditions is supposed to be like from a physical perspective. I'll review both like what it means in the B model and what it means in the A model. And then I'll try and explain sort of what Benji and Aaron and I were able to do. Okay, all right. So what I'd like to then do is start with the question of just how does one study the two category of boundary conditions? And so the answer is that you compactify the theory on an interval. And in order to get an A and a B twist of 3D n equals 4, you have to choose a 2D n equals 2, 2 subalgebra. And so the result is an infinite dimensional n equals 2 comma 2 gauge Landau-Ginzburg model. And it was written down. I mean, I'm sure lots of people had known how to do it, but one place that you can find it written down, so it's in the appendix to the first paper that I wrote with Davide. It's in Appendix A, just in case you want to look it up later. But let me just try and explain precisely what this thing looks like. So it basically ends up being a holomorphic version of the kind of LG model, or sorry, the kind of thing that you get when you want to study floor theory. So the LG model that you get has a target space of maps from the interval. I'm going to go ahead and choose a gauge theory where I'm going to choose some sort of matter representation. So there's some sort of quaternionic representation in an action of a group. And then a complexified connection of the gauge group on the trivial bundle over the interval. So this is the target. So this space right here is just basically, yes, C infinity functions valued in this quaternionic representation. This thing, a connection on the trivial bundle, well, that's really just the same thing as a map from 0, 1 to the complexified Lie algebra times dt. And then it has, this thing has an interesting gauge group where the gauge group is a path group where if you study the space of maps from the interval into the gauge group, and it turns out that this is actually that the action of this gauge group on the fields. Well, one thing is that when I chose my A and B twists, I implicitly chose a complex structure on this quaternionic representation M. So you can think of this thing as being a Kähler manifold, an infinite dimensional Kähler manifold. And this is actually a Hamiltonian action. So the moment map for this action, so this action here is Hamiltonian. And so the moment map is basically the following. So if I have a map psi and a connection B, then part of the moment map is easy to describe. So my action of G on M was actually tri-Hamiltonian. So I have the real moment map with respect to complex structure I, and I can just compose that with psi. And so that will actually give me now something that lives in the Lie algebra of this group, which is just a path in the ordinary Lie algebra. And then the extra bit is, so yeah, let me actually call this thing B dt. So I think that this thing is, minus the derivative with respect to the coordinate on the 0, 1 of b minus the derivative with respect to b bar plus the commutator of b and b bar. So this thing as Hamiltonian with this particular moment map. One way that you can get this moment map is it's very well known that if I had looked at maps from the surface, or if I had looked at connections on the surface, that has a moment map. And you can just take this imaginary connection. You can instead just think of the imaginary part as being the connection in the like in a transverse two-dimensional direction. And if you use the formula for like the two-dimensional, like the well-known formula that's just the curvature is the moment map. If I had connections on a surface, then this thing is just like that component of the curve, is just the curvature. So this thing has like this interesting gauge group, and then it has a superpotential. And so the superpotential is basically the following. It's basically you take the interval over 0, 1. So since I've chosen a complex structure here on this quaternionic vector space, you can also think of it as a complex symplectic vector space. So there's like a complex symplectic form, and I can choose like a Louisville form. So I can take the complex Louisville form and pull it back under the map psi. And then I can add on, I can pair the complex moment map. I can pair that with B and then integrate. So this thing has an interesting superpotential.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Now, why are there no boundary conditions?
I haven't put them on yet.
Okay, so so far your superpotential depends on the choice of primitive.
Yeah, so here I haven't constrained my maps at all to lie on any boundary condition. So I'm just saying you can just try and rewrite the theory. Like it's not going to be a well-defined theory because I've got manifold with boundary. Right now I'm just rewriting everything. If this had been a closed manifold, everything that I had said would be correct. But now I have to put in boundary conditions.
Okay.
Right. So basically, like everything that I have said so far, would be literally true if I had a closed one manifold here instead of the interval. And so actually, let me just for one second talk about that case. So let me just let this be just a closed connected one manifold. So either this, so basically it's got to be the circle. But at least now I'm not lying. Yeah, it's probably a good idea that before I talk about the boundary conditions, talk about the case of a closed manifold. So if I let N1 just be the circle, then I can A or B twist. This LG model. And like in the, so let me do the B twist first because it's because it's nicer. So another way that I could have written this superpotential is if I broke my if I chose like Darboux coordinates. Like on M, another way that I could have chosen to write the superpotential, so like let me like break psi into like coordinate Darboux coordinates like x and y. Then another way that I could have written this is it's the integral over this closed one manifold of like x, y, like basically the dt. X dby. And like you'll notice that like if you study the critical points of this, it's basically just telling you that your functions x and y are constant. And like in this B model, it turns out that like you'll want to study matrix factorizations with respect to the superpotential, And it turns out that this is just like quadratic. And whenever you're studying matrix factorizations with something quadratic, you can just localize the whole thing like onto the critical points. And so like here, you just end up getting something like coherent sheaves into the space of flat maps. And there's like a little bit of fanciness where you find that you need to take half. So like if your M broke into like V plus V dual, like your X and your Y coordinates, then like you actually just end up getting this thing, which is just equal, as I said, to like some space of matrix factorizations on my target potential W. So these things like end up being like the same. So this is like a model that Tudor likes a lot. And then I don't want to lose this thing yet. So I'm going to go ahead and erase it and tell you about the A model. And so in the A model, you get something like entirely differently. Like, so instead of studying matrix factorizations, you're going to study Fekaya-Seidel category of this. Of this target with the super potential W. And this thing is a lot more mysterious. But it's conjectured, it was conjectured by, anybody who's working in this like holomorphic topological language that we like so much. That this thing ought to be like very closely related to basically D modules on the loop space. But I don't expect this equivalence to be literally true. This is kind of like some analog of like the normal case that there's often a close relationship between Fekaya-Seidel categories and D modules. So I'm actually going to tell you what this Fekaya-Seidel category looks like in a second, but I want to wait until I put in the boundary conditions.
One of the things that I've always sort of wondered about, understanding knot homology, like thinking about a knot as an element of the loop space.
Yeah, this one you could literally do that. You could literally do that in this one. Yeah. But basically then you have to do hard analysis. And actually, let me just tell you a little tiny bit about like the analysis, because I think it tells you something that I think is like well known to like all the physicists working in the subject, but I think is not well known to all of the representation theorists working in the subject. And that is like what exactly even are the equations in the 3DA model? I think like, you know, obviously Nakajima I think knows, but I'm not 100% sure that this is like really filtered out into common knowledge. So when you're studying like this 2D LG model, like, let me just remind you about like, like in particular, like what are the equations of motion? So you know that like in a normal A model, like you're studying maps from like a surface, like a complex surface, like into some sort of a target. And like you know that in an ordinary thing, you're just studying like the holomorphic map equation, or like the. But you might ask like, you know, like what is it that happens? Like when you have a superpotential. And so the equation that like you end up studying is called the Witten equation. The Witten equation is basically that del bar of your map is no longer equal to is no longer equal to zero, but now it's equal to the gradient of W, where you take the gradient with respect to like the Hermitian metric. And so it's like a holomorphic version of like a gradient flow equation. And then there's like a fancier version where like if I have like a group around, then like you can make like what's called the gauged Witten equation. And in the gauged Witten equation, like basically now I'll have an extra field, which will be a connection. Rather than have a map from U, I need to have a G bundle together with like a section of the associated X bundle. Just the derivative, you have to take this, the covariantized derivative. But then there's an extra equation where the curvature of your connection has to be equal to the moment map for H. So this is like the gauged Witten equation. And if you run this like on this particular choice of target and group, what you end up finding is the Seiberg-Witten equation. So let me just write that down one time. Sorry, this one board is really cramping the style. So if you run this on this one, like in this example, the thing that you find is basically now you have function phi on a three manifold. On a three manifold, and you have some sort of section of like your matter bundle. But in the A model, now these things are like not only a G representation, these things were also like a representation of the unit quaternions, which you identify with the Euclidean group in dimension three. And so you can use this, that you can basically twist it by both a G bundle and by like a spin bundle. So yeah, you have like a G bundle P and a spin bundle, or the spin bundle on your free manifold. And you can twist this thing. These things become a spinner. And then your other fields are you have an adjoint valued scalar and a complexified adjoint valued scalar. And then they satisfy and a connection. And then the equations that you get are basically dA phi plus sigma phi 0. Here this is like the Dirac equation, like on my spinners. Then you also have an equation of the form of the curvature. You can take the Hodge star. Now this thing is a one form, which you can identify now with an imaginary quaternion. So then you can actually identify this thing with the moment map. This is the quaternionic moment map for M. And then also you have the same thing for dA sigma. And then you have a bunch of equations that tell you that zero is equal to the covariant derivative of phi, is equal to the bracket of phi and psi, so bracket of phi and phi bar, and so all these things are zero. And then, in special cases, so when phi is equal to zero, and the other phi is equal to zero, then these things become the Bogle-Monnier equations for monopoles. But then when, and then when sigma and phi are equal to zero, then these things are what people normally call 3D Seiberg wind. And like basically, like you can just derive these directly, like from that, and applying the Witten equation to that superpotential. Okay, but now, like what I want to do is try and alter this thing when N1 is a manifold with boundary, like the interval, and sort of see like what kind of thing that we get. Well, this thing be an interval. So now the theory is not quite well defined. Like when you're deriving like the Seiberg-Witten equations, like using this this superpotential. Like basically you'll do an integration by parts and there'll be boundary terms that you need to cancel. So you need to cancel the boundary terms and the variation of phi. Or sorry, the variation of the superpotential. It's very well known, so let me just assume that I have no B for a moment. So like there's no gauge group. Then this is just exactly a complexified version of the ordinary symplectic action that like you study when you study like Lagrangian floor theory. And it's very well known that like if you want to cancel the boundary terms there, that you need to require that your map ends on an exact Lagrangian. And so here, like you get literally like the exact same thing. And so what it requires is that your map psi of zero is contained in something like the an exact or L0, one, where these are just basically exact Lagrangians. And then you also need to, you can impose like various sorts of things about the way that these are going to interact with the gauge group. Just for simplicity, I'm just going to assume that these things are G invariant, because then that makes my life. G invariant, and then that puts like basically a also something on the connection. So they need to be in G in the perpendicular to the stabilizer group. So I think these things just have to both be zero on the boundary. Okay, so you can study like now like an analog of the same thing, where like now instead of studying the space of like all maps from the interval, I like study ones that like satisfy these properties. And these are holomorphic Lagrangian submanifolds. They're exact with respect to the holomorphic symplectic form. Okay, and then like now like one can just run like the same analysis that I did all over again. And like what one ends up finding is that if you're doing the B model, things just localize onto constant maps again. And so like what you end up like finding it like naively is just something that quantizes like the intersection of your two submanifolds. And like that's basically exactly, and like if one was like zero section and the other one was like the graph of a one form, that's just matrix factorization, or a graph of a D of a function, that's just matrix factorizations. And so this is like what KRS did So on the B side, basically KRS used this to show basically the morphism category. Between, say, a zero section, or well, actually, I wanted to say the graph of DF0 and the graph of DF1. It's just exactly the matrix factorizations for the super for F0 minus F1. And this thing ends up just being like totally finite dimensional. Okay, but now like that we're gonna like analyze the A side, which will actually be like a lot more interesting. Anybody still leaving? All right. So now let's go ahead and analyze the A model. And just for now, let's just assume no group, gauge group. Just because it makes my life slightly easier. So now, like what you end up studying, right, are these space of maps. Right. Okay. And so we're studying this Fekaya-Seidel category on this space of maps from 0 to 1 into M, together with like these Lagrangian boundary conditions determined by, you know, L0 and L1 with respect to this superpotential. And now you have to basically add on a boundary term, which is this is the graph of DF0 and this is the graph of DF1. You have to basically add on a term that looks like that. Okay, and like one like might be interested in like what this thing like just actually is. So the objects of this thing are supposed to be the critical points of W. And so like one can ask like, what are they? And like if you look at this thing, well, we already answered this in like the case of the B model, it's basically just telling you that these are they're just constant maps. So these things are basically just in bijection with constant maps into L0 intersect L1. And then one can ask, like, how do I compute like the morphism spaces? So in the morphism, to study the morphism spaces, these critical points are basically going to, each one has a complex number associated to it, namely the critical value. And one can take like the direction between these two critical values, and that's going to determine some number called a phase, which I'll call sigma. And so these things are going to be solutions to what's called the zeta soliton equation. So this is basically just exactly the same as the Witten. So this is just like very much like the Witten equation, except for now I only have a map of one variable. I'm asking for it to be equal to the gradient of W. And so the solutions to the soliton equation, though, we can identify them with something that's like a little bit more familiar. And it turns out if you look at like this particular superpotential and see what these things are, turns out that these things are exactly pseudo-holomorphic curves or pseudo-holomorphic strips. But they're in a complex structure that depends on the face. J zeta, which is going to depend on, which is going to be something like cosine of zeta times J plus sine of zeta times K, where these are the other two complex structures that like you're not using for your model. And I you know, could be that you use a minus, you know, whatever, it's very close. So like now, like you've got a category whose like objects are critical points and whose morphisms are pseudo-holomorphic strips. But that's like exactly like a categorification of ordinary floor theory. Like right, in ordinary floor theory, you build a like a chain complex whose like objects are critical points, and then you build a differential like using like the pseudo-holomorphic strips. And like this thing's just literally categorifying that. And then although these morphism spaces are actually still not well defined, right? This is only the like rough approximation to the morphism space. I still have to add the differential here. And so the differential is basically now you count, you use the zeta instanton equation. So that's basically exactly the same equation that I wrote down before. That was this del bar, it's this Witten equation, except for just with, oh, sorry, there was supposed to be a zeta bar here in the last equation too. So it's just the exact same equation I had before, but just with this extra scalar in it. And like one can ask, like, what are those things for like this particular superpotential? And they're just going to be solutions to like the Dirac equation. So like basically like to compute the differential, like you have to compute like the Dirac equation or count solutions to the Dirac equation. So this is, I think this is like probably very well known to physicists, but maybe like less so, I think, to mathematicians. And Benji and Aaron and I like did not decide to go this way. And the reason that we didn't decide to go this way is not that we couldn't compute this space. Like probably we could have computed this Fukuyama-Seidel category. But the real problem is that like you can't compute the morphisms. Like if I have three Lagrangians and like I want to try and compute you know, the Fukuyama-Seidel category for L1 and L2 and the Fukuyama-Seidel category for L2 and L3 and compute the morphism spaces or compute the multiplication to the Fukuyama-Seidel category for L1 and L3, like I just have no idea of how to do that. Like it's much harder. So we had to find some like completely like different approach. So how am I doing on time? Oh, okay, so the.
So I mean, I think our traditional thing is you should come to a starting point by 2:30
and then. Or an ending point. Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's great. Okay, so basically like this is like what we could not do. But I think it's like interesting at least to like, to know like what it is that we were physically trying to do. And so we looked for a different approach. So if you examine like what happened like with the A model, so now here's the part. Aaron Maisel G. And Gamage. So we decided to take like a completely different tack, and we were like, okay, so we're looking for something that like categorifies a Fukuyama category. And fortunately, Kapranov and Schechtman had already come up with things that categorified the Fukuyama category in certain contexts, and those things are called perverse Schobers. So like our idea is use the perverse Schobers Kapranov Okay, so let me like explain like what these things are. So so first, I just want to recall that there is an equivalence between the subset of the Fakaya category of C supported on or with Lagrangian skeleton on the cotangent bundle of zero union the zero section. It's well known that this thing is the same thing as Persburg sheaves on C with a singularity at the origin. This is like up to like some size issues, but you can make a big version of Persburg sheaves to make this literally true. So then second, there is a well-known description of Persburg sheaves where it's well known that this is just pairs of vector spaces, basically the nearby and vanishing cycles together with morphisms between them, such that one minus, sorry, I don't know why I called that T, it should have been a V. One minus UV and one minus VU are invertible. So geometrically, inside of T star C, one has this Lagrangian skeleton. And to this Lagrangian skeleton, there are these two linking disks. And HOMs with these linking disks are either get u, phi, or psi. So there's these like two like interesting Lagrangians in here. I guess I should draw them like this. And if you and they generate this whole Fakaya category, and if you can represent this Fakaya category as vector spaces just by looking at HOMs out of phi and HOMs out of psi, this will give you this and this. And if you compute the HOMs between these two guys, then that'll give you these two morphisms.
Where do the conditions on invertibility come from?
Those are so you know, really this is a picture in like the complex plane. And the vector space that's associated to this point has a monodromy from like coming, like if I think of the complex plane like coming out of the board here, there's a monodromy like going around this hyperplane. Right? Like this is a picture of T star C, not a picture of C. Or right, like this is like a, so there's a this is a C and that's a C. And there's like a monodromy. Does that make sense? And this thing is these are supposed to be formulas for the more, and this one also has a monodromy going around this other hyperplane. Okay, so this was like our idea. And let me just throw in something else that we were able, that we knew in advance. So from like this BFN Springer theory that like Joel and Alex and I worked out, we knew how to, we knew two Lagrangians on the mirror side. I mean, although we also knew this like just from my paper with Davide, but mathematically you could find two Lagrangians that look like this you can see that these things are mirror to the Lagrangians C mod C star T star zero. Sorry, the cotangent fiber to BC star inside of the mirror. So basically, this thing is just the equivariant version of the coordinate cross. And so basically, like, you know, these things in category are like simple modules, and these things are projectives. So like we knew that was true. So I'll use that in a second. Okay, but using this like description perverse sheaves, Kapranov and Shekman defined the notion of a perverse Schober. So I'll call this thing perv 2, C0. And that's going to be the following. So here I'm just going to have two categories, one corresponding to phi and one corresponding to psi. And then I want to have an adjoint set of functors between them. So these are going to be categorifying these u and v that I had before. And this is going to be an adjoint set of functors. And then now I need to figure out how to categorify this equation about the invertibility. Well, and the point is that there's always a map from the identity on phi to the composition of the right adjoint with the left adjoint. And I can take the cone on this map. It gives me some automorphism, some monodromy, or some endomorphism of phi, which I'll call T phi. And so you can ask that this thing be invertible. So taking this cone categorifies the difference. And then similarly, I have a similar thing where you have SSR maps to, oh, sorry, this thing should have been the fiber of that map. And I could have taken the cone, and I can ask for that to be invertible. That also categorifies the difference. And this is like my category of like perverse Schobers. And I want to try and show that this what we ended up trying to show is that this category of perverse Schobers was basically dual to the bit of the KRS category that's generated by the structure, the categorification of the structure sheaf of this object and the categorification of the structure sheaf of that object. And so the statement that we proved perv 2, C comma 0, is going to be isomorphic to the category of modules over coherent sheaves C mod C star union 0 mod C star, sorry, disjoint union, fiber producted with itself over C mod C star. And then this thing, sorry, not quite this category. So this category is monoidal under convolution. And then we looked at the two category of module categories. And so this was the thing that we managed to prove. So this is a reasonable place to stop, but let me just say that we also proved an enhancement of this theorem. So we also showed that there is an S1 action on the category of perverse Schobers. And that the S1 invariant category is equal to the analogous thing, but where now I undo the gauging on the other side. And so then, like, and the techniques that we use to prove this basically generalized to let us prove it for any, like, any pair of Guildwell things. So this is, like, maybe, like, where I'll stop, and then, like, now if people want to know, I'll tell you, like, how we actually prove it or that kind of stuff.
Are there any questions?
From Zoom?
Yeah. I have a question.
Okay.
Can you use this to derive previously known results about both local operators, for instance, or both line operators?
So I don't think, because of this restriction on the singular support, I think that the only statements we'd be able to get would be about, like, local operators and, like, the massive, like in the massive theory, when you've turned on the mass parameters, and that's, like, not as interesting. Like, basically, like, there it should just be functions, like, on the critical points. I think that on the, but as far as the line operators, like that, like, we're actually, like, working on now, we don't expect to get all line operators. So basically what we expect is that, you know, rather than getting, like, all D modules, like in this example, like, instead of getting all D modules on the loop space of C, we expect to only be able to get ones that are, like, O star monodromic, or like monodromic for, you know, the arc group. And like on the other side, we have kind of like an interesting thing here. And that's actually like not that surprising, because there was like some work that some of Tudor's students did, Andrew Ballin and Wenjin Niu, where basically they showed that like that was the only that was like a small category that actually was braided monoidal. And like the thing that Sam and I wrote down, it's like a chiral category, but it's way too big to be like an honest braided monoidal category. And so you're like, basically, like, if you're going to be building a TQFT, you're going to expect to find something like small, like smaller. And so there's like some natural things. So we're working on that now, like basically about the open. We're also working on the open close map. Like basically there ought to be a map between, right, the HOMs between two Lagrangians, like the open string invariant, and then like to the category of line operators. And together with like Lev Rozansky and Alexia Blomkov, we're trying to understand how you can use that to get like knot homology. So like basically that was actually the impetus for this project, is Tudor and I were working on like how to get, basically there's an analog of this open closed map, like on the B side that Lev and Alexi built. And we were trying to build, and I wanted to build the same open closed map. And then we started looking at that Fakaya category that I wrote down earlier, and then it started to become kind of hard. And then, because we were doing it for the Hilbert scheme. And then we were trying to like write down the open closed map to line operators, and that was like getting like kind of hard. So like I was kind of trying to go back to first principles and be like, how does one actually like write down like these morphism categories between Lagrangians? And now we're trying to work out how to do the open closed map just in these simple abelian examples. And then once we can do that, we'll try and revisit the Hilbert scheme and see like whether we can use it to like construct knot homology. So that's like that. I mean, that's like really like what all this is for, but we're not, I mean, I wouldn't say that we're that close like to doing the Hilbert scheme. Yeah.
So one more question in this direction. Is it possible to write down a PDE whose solutions give you the knot homology? Even if you can't prove a statement, even if you can't prove a theorem yet.
Yeah, probably.
If you want to get the analysts to be interested in this, I think you should do that. They'd be very excited.
Yeah, I think, so that's like what Tudor and I are kind of revisiting now. So like we're trying to finish up this knot homology paper. We don't have the open string map. Like basically we just have like what the object that you get in the Fakaya category is, or in the category of line operators is, but we're restricted to like only certain knots. So yeah, maybe we should write down the analytic thing just for an arbitrary knot.
Well, it would be interesting to know how it compares with like this Whitman stuff. It's all squared.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm not an expert on not like on the knot homologies, like that's like more tutor's deal. Like I was just kind of like doing the, but yeah, that would be very, be extremely, extremely interesting.
Maybe that's kind of philosophically wrong, because this is supposed to be giving Homply homology.
Yeah, Homply PT, you know, the graded Homply. Yeah, so I think we could write down a moduli space, and then like you know, and like also like there ought to be like this monopole action, like this Chernyk algebra action that we can get in some cases, but like we can't get for an arbitrary knot. As of yet. It's these algebraic knots because we need to use like the BFN construction. Like, and so like you're sort of restricted to being like knots, yeah, that are like realized as the eigenvalues of a loop of matrices. Yeah, so an algebraic loop of matrices. If I could do an analytic loop or just a smooth loop of matrices, then I could do any knot. But I can't do that right now. So that's like some things. The other thing, yeah, so anyway, so there are questions of that nature. I can also try and tell you a little bit about how the how the proof goes. Like we prove like some kind of interesting things to do this. I don't know how interested you guys are in that. Or I don't know, Davide. I can't hear you.
So can you generalize these definitions to general non-abelian theories, even if you don't have a proof of the mirror symmetry?
For example, so basically
have to M N with the G and G invariant things.
So I think it's gonna be really hard. So let me maybe like now would be the time to start actually like telling you like how some definitions work, so I can tell you like where stuff gets hard. Like basically I can tell you like why we can't like do it just like easily for a non-abelian theory if you knew a little bit about the definition. So let me maybe tell you a little bit of like how this works. So yes, yeah, so like let's like, so the key thing that I'd want to know, so there's like two key things that I'd want to know if I wanted to move on to a non-abelian theory. So the first one is like, what Lagrangian do I choose? And I kind of suspect that like there isn't a great answer for this. Like the kind of thing that I would want to choose is, Ben wrote down this interesting skeleton in for pre-O, but it actually like is not a Lagrangian skeleton. It actually like you know, it's one of these ones where there's like boundary degrees of boundary matter. So like basically like it's not an immersed Lagrangian. It's like an interesting vibration. Or it's not really a vibration, but there's like an interesting thing. And so like, I don't know how to handle those type of things in Perber-Schober language. So that's like number one thing, is that like, if I were gonna start with my vector space, I would need to like prove a new statement about like, what are Perver-Sheaves like on this particular vector space with this Ben skeleton, this pre-O skeleton. But let me just assume that I could do that. So then like the next like place where things like would go wrong is like the key thing that we used here is this S1 action on the category of Perver-Schobers. So you can ask like, what the hell is an S1 action on a, or what is an S1 action on a 2 category? So an S1 action on a 2 category, or actually a group action in a 2 category, this is the same thing. So like, I'll give you obvious answer that's completely useless, and then I'll like slowly like refine it to something like more and more useful. So the obvious answer is that if I have any group, I can make a infinity two category, sorry, an infinity three category, whose objects are, there's just one object, and then the morphism space is that group. So that's like the thing that we call like BG. And then I guess sometimes I call it like BG Betty because I'm only using the topological type of the group. So there's like, so this is like some interesting infinity. I mean, really it's an infinity groupoid. So it's actually an infinity in category for any N. And so one can just say like, okay, an action of a group on a two category is just some functor into the infinity three category of stable two categories. So that's like pretty useless. And this is kind of like a souped up version of something Telemann did in his ICM. He did this for a one category, like the one category. Okay, so then like now, like you say like, okay, well like, can I actually do something with this? So like, what is this data? So this data is the same thing as choosing a category. Like that's like where this unique point goes, plus a map from G into the endomorphisms of that category. Okay, that's like still maybe not that useful. Because like it's pretty hard to like construct those, especially like in a homotopy coherent way. So this one has to be an E1 algebra map, or just an associative algebra map. Okay, so then though you can say like, okay, well if my group is connected, so G is connected, well now I can say like, okay, well that's just a map from the base loop space of G into the endomorphisms of the identity functor of C. And now this thing has to be an E2 map. And this thing here is just a category. This thing is just a category. And if you want to, you can basically stabilize this to make it into a category. But the point is that like we were studying tori. And when you're a torus, there are no higher homotopy groups. So this thing is still just discrete. It's just a discrete set of points, right? It's just the pi one. So for a torus, this thing is just isomorphic to pi one of G. And so we were actually able to construct this action. But actually, you might think that this is like really easy. But in fact, it's incredibly hard because an E2 map has like tons of extra like higher homotopy coherences. And like in constructing like E2 maps from the integers is actually like extremely hard. There's like a huge paper that like Jacob Lurie like wrote where he constructs one just on like the category of stable categories, where like it took him like 90 pages to prove that it was like E2. So, but we were actually able to cheat and like find actually a way that we could see that ours was E2. We actually had to prove mirror symmetry, construct the action on the other side where it was obviously E2, and then like basically port it over and see that it matched an obvious geometric thing. Like there is no way to like, there's like an obvious like guess for what the action is. But basically you just can't prove it's E2. So like basically like we had to use mirror symmetry to construct this map. So it was like quite difficult. Like this was actually one of the, we thought it was gonna, like this was actually one of the more surprising things that we couldn't build this by hand. But anyway, but the point is, Davide, for your question, like if my group was not a torus, like this space is now incredibly interesting. And like basically like constructing like an E2 map, but like this, you know, so if I stabilize this, it's going to be some like interesting like E2 category, which is like quite complicated, or some braided monoidal category, which is like very complicated. And I need to like construct some braided monoidal like map to this thing. So this thing's like is a braided monoidal category. And like basically constructing that is like extremely difficult. So it's like not at all obvious that like that we could do it for like a group. Like basically we were exactly smart enough to do this case.
So I'm trying to understand exactly what the physical obstruction is here. So
I mean the physical obstruction is just that like G, like the homotopy groups of G are complicated.
No, that's right. So usually we'll be trying to represent G as domain walls in your theory.
Yeah.
I guess trying to this in it doing so in a derived sense
Like, yeah, so that's what this is.
Interesting things happening.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's basically like, because like basically the relations between these interfaces are going to be governed by the topology of the group. And the topology of the group, if the topology of the group is complicated, if it has like higher homotopy groups, like it can have infinitely many higher homotopy groups, like up into like arbitrarily high dimension. Like, and so like, it's like an infinite amount of data to construct this action.
Is it all about the topology of the group? Is also something about the Lie algebra of the group?
I cannot see the, so this one's just purely topological. Mm-hmm. So people do this thing where they call, like, they have the Durham actions where you do like a smooth action plus you trivialize the Lie algebra. And like, that's like something that's like basically this, like the same as this, but you can do it strictly in topology. You don't need to remember that your group was. So anyway, so that's like where things would go wrong is that like so these are the interfaces. Like, this is the thing that you were saying where you just like do it as G as a bunch of interfaces of your theory. Like, that's what this is. But the topology here is very complicated. So if we had a good theory of perverse Schober's, if we had a geometric theory of perverse Schober's that was like functorial, like this would just be all free. But because like you build your perverse Schober's like by taking this like non-geometric construction of like perverse sheaves to start, like basically like this is extremely hard. Like if one had like an analytic, like the analytic construction of perverse Schober's, you might imagine that this is free. Like basically like the thing with these kind of things is that they're either free from functoriality or they're very hard. Like basically you can't do it by hand. Like you just need to like, so this is like where things like get hard, like in that statement. Let me maybe say like one other thing. So one thing that we like showed as well is like, so when this thing is pi one of a group, you know, since this thing is like a stable category, you can just complete this thing to a stable category. And this thing is actually coherent sheaves on the Langlands stool group. Like these two categories are the same as E2 categories. And so like actually like the way that we like prove our theorem is we actually prove geometric Langlands, like for a two categorical version of geometric Langlands, where we show that like categories with a topological G action, two categories with a topological G action are the same thing as categories with a coherent action of like the Langlands dual group. And so like that's like actually the strategy that we use to prove. And so now I could try and tell you a little bit about like how one actually, or if you're interested, I can try and tell you a little bit more concretely about how you prove this theorem about perverse Schober's being the same as this convolution algebra. I mean, if that's interesting, there's some cool stuff in there. Yeah, I mean, basically it's up to you. If you want to go home, like you guys are the only ones in the audience. So like if you're tired, then that's fine.
There are people who just haven't showed up on Zoom.
Oh, there are?
Yeah, there are like
Oh, okay. I just haven't seen anybody. They're like, I can't see who's here.
I think no one else turned on their video.
I'm listening.
Okay. Yeah, so then if anybody would like to see like how you prove this statement about the convolution algebras, I can show you or like say a little bit about it.
Well, you clearly
I clearly want to. That's yeah. True.
Go ahead.
So let's like think about like the way that this thing works. And the reason that I'm so excited about it is because it actually just tells you something about just about like adjunctions that I think nobody knew before. So it's like basically like it's like a very like it turns out to have like some very basic results in category theory that like were completely surprising, I think, to the people who knew about higher categories. So first, like, let's like try and figure out like more rigorously how does one define the perverse Schober's two category. So the first thing is that actually it's a full subcategory of something easy, or easier. And that is it's a full subcategory of something that we'll call stable adjunctions. The two category of stable adjunctions. So let me tell you what this thing is. So basically, there's a two category, which is just the, sorry, a three category, which is just the three category of all stable two categories. And then inside of this, there is a universal object, which I'll call adj. And it's like the universal walking adjunction. So basically, it's the category that has two objects in it. We'll call them plus and minus. And there's a functor L that goes one way, a functor R that goes the other way. And then these things are adjoint to one another. So there's basically a free category just on that data. And because this thing is stable, I might as well just stabilize this thing. So basically here, these endomorphism spaces will be themselves categories, and I might as well just replace them, make them all stable. Okay, so this is an interesting thing, which is just purely in category theory. This is a very interesting object. And it actually is well known. I can never spell this guy's name. It's Chanel and Street gave a presentation of this thing. Well, actually, sorry, let me tell you, maybe even let me just say a little bit more about what this category has in it. So yeah, it's got this left, it's got this right. And then the two most important objects in this category is there's a guy RL, and then there's another guy LR. And this guy is a monad, and this guy is a comonad. So let me just remind you what this thing is. So basically, the endomorphisms of this object minus are some monoidal category, under composition. And this thing is just equal to that's the same thing. It's just saying that it's a co-monoid under composition. So that means that there's a map from C to C composed C. And then there is a map from C to the identity of minus. And similarly, this guy is just a monoid under the convolution product or under the composition product. So there's a map from M composed M to M. And then there's a map from one, one to M. And we've used this thing before. This is that map, the unit, and this is that co-unit map, which I inverted to get my twist. Okay, and so it turns out that that's really essentially all there is here is basically this category is basically the free one that contains a monoid. And this one's actually the free category that contains a comonoid. And these things are slightly more complicated, and it's well known what these things are. So the concrete description of this guy is minus plus categories going back and forth. And so the category of endomorphisms here is a copy of the topologist's or the algebraist simplex category. And then here is the opposite of that category. So let me just remind you. So this is the category whose objects are finite ordered sets. And whose morphisms are order-preserving maps. And so there's only a finite, and you can put all of these finite ordered sets just into bijection with the standard ones, 0 through through n, like with like the standard order, then this thing is like order preserving maps. And so this thing's slightly bigger than like the thing that indexes simplicial objects, because this thing has the empty set in it. So that gives you like one, there's no empty simplex in topology, but this thing has an empty object on it. And basically it's well known that this thing is actually just the free category on a monoid. And basically the monoid in this case is the object one with its obvious multiplication map from two. There's only one order preserving map here, and there's only one order preserving map from, indexing is off by one. So there's only one possible unit map here and one possible thing here. And then similarly, this is just the opposite. So this thing's free on a comonoid. And then these things are basically the subset of these categories that either always preserve the top element or always preserve the bottom element. Like we restrict the maps to just preserve the top or preserve the bottom. So like this is actually like a very like relatively simple category. You can like write it down in like some finite amount of data. And then what we want to do is that this category stable, well, it's basically the full subcategory of this where like the twists are invertible. So basically this thing is you take this stabilization of the free adjunction. So that's a pretty complicated operation, but basically what it lets you do is it lets you form cones and fibers. And then now you just invert the fiber of the unique unit map from one to my monoid. So you invert that object, and then you invert the cofiber of the map from your comonoid to the unit. You invert that. So basically, the question is, we have to compute like what the heck is this category? And like if we, you know, one thing that you could imagine doing is just like try and use this presentation and just like not muscle through and then show that this thing is equal to the category that I wanted. So our theorem is that this thing is just equal to the category with two objects. One of these things is supposed to be coherent sheaves on C mod C star. It's like one of the convolution factors. The other one is supposed to be coherent sheaves on zero over C mod C star. And then these two things are just supposed to be copies of coherent sheaves on BC star. So like this is like the theorem that we were trying to prove. But it turns out that this is basically impossible to do by hand. Because if you do this in like a truly homotopical way, like this operation is like so terrible that like you just like can't possibly like get your hands on it. I mean, maybe somebody who's smarter than us or like who really like combinatorics could have done it. But like this seemed like very difficult. So we actually ended up handling this by proving like a really cool result, which is like it was well known to topologists in a different setting, but like I think that it's like kind of surprising. And it's basically just the following fact. So you know that like if I have a surjective ring map, that like that's determined by just the kernel. Well, in like topology, like you can't talk about like surjective and injective maps. And it just turns out that like there's a map from the unit to any algebra in a stable category, which you should think of as like a ring, any monoid in a stable category, which is like the stable version of a ring. And it turns out that you can take the kernel of that map. And it turns out that the kernel knows everything. Like, so everything is a quotient of like one by an ideal, or every algebra is the quotient of one by an ideal. So let me like say that in a more smart way. So like the way that we prove this is we prove that like this monoid, so this M, so this thing is, again, this thing is like an algebra or a monoid in a stable category. So you should think of this, if you don't like comatopy, you should think of it as like a monoid in an abelian category. So you should think of this as just being like a ring. And there's this unit map from the trivial ring, which is just like the unit, like in this the identity object in this category. I think we were calling this thing minus one before. And you can take the fiber of the unit. So let me call this thing I. So you should think of this thing as like an ideal. And it turns out that that this thing actually knows all the data about M. So let me like say like what that is. So it turns out that this thing has the following structure. So it turns out that you can that this I is basically the image of a functor from the negative or sorry the non-positive integers under less than it's a monoidal functor from this into So sorry, so this thing was a monoid. I could just say that this thing's a monoid in an arbitrary category C. And I claim that this thing is the same, it has to be a monoidal category to make sense of having a monoid. And I claim that basically this I can be upgraded into the object of a functor from this category, which is has objects 0, minus 1, minus 2, and so on. And then there's just like a unique map. Like if one is smaller than the other. And this thing has an obvious tensor structure just under addition. And like one can like upgrade this I to a tensor functor that sends 0 goes to the unit of C, and then minus 1 goes to I. And it turns out that this thing knows all the data of my monoid, which is the same thing since as a functor from delta plus. A tensor functor from delta plus. So it turns out that there's like an interesting equivalence between these things. And like, why is this interesting? Well, this category that I started with, you know, it was basically like a copy of delta plus. And if I don't invert the twist, I can actually just replace it with a copy of z less than. And if I like invert the twist, then I'll just get a copy of z. And if I stabilize that, that's exactly what it achieves on C mod C star. Like it's filtered vector spaces. And like that's like how like this like whole proof goes. So you prove like this like really, so this thing all just comes down to some crazy statement that like if you want to know like an algebra in a stable category, it's enough, they can all just be presented also by this ideal. And it's the same amount of data. Like if you remember like this extra structure on the ideal, like it knows the same amount of things. So like in stable infinity categories, you can present monoids like instead of by giving multiplication, just by giving ideals and the identity. And I think that like this is like a crazy like sort of statement, but it was like kind of known to topologists under the theory of like Smith ideals is like what this is. But they decided that this was useless. They actually decided that this meant that the idea of an ideal was stupid in homotopy theory. Like because everything is an ideal and like everything is a quotient. So you can't use it to do anything interesting. But we decided that so they like discarded this thing. But we decided that in fact this was a very interesting fact, and like it lets you prove this thing. So I'll stop. But it anyway, this is like some really weird.
All right. Let's try this again.